Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 79. Matt Scalise, editor of FilmNerds.com. Ben Flanagan of Aspect Radio.
Hey, Matt, what's going on?
Hey, Ben.
So, Matt, we have both seen Quentin Tarantino's 8th film, as he reminded us in the marketing and opening credits, of The Hateful Eight, this new Western that you and I, obviously, and all of the film nerds, for that matter, as big Tarantino fans, have been anticipating, hotly anticipating, even in the year of Star Wars. So, you had the privilege, I guess we'll call it. I don't know if I would consider it the same thing.
No, that's not a great word for it, but I did it.
of reading this leaked script from, I guess, a couple of years ago now or a year ago, I can't even recall the exact timeline, that Tarantino got all pissy about. And rightly so. It's his script. It shouldn't have been leaked, and he should have, you know, released it as he wanted to. But you read it. You saw it, or so you think you did. I'm sure you did, Matt. But I'm curious, you know, not to get too complicated here, having read that a couple of years ago or whenever that was, and now having waited so long to see if it would be the exact same as what you read, or if you would make some changes to those pages and give you something a little different on screen, did The Hateful Eight measure up to what you read on the page, or on your computer screen, rather, whenever that was?
Well, I will say that for a long time, I felt like having read it and assuming it was real made me sort of more excited about seeing the movie, and I think it did. Definitely, so first of all, I saw what was definitely a version of the script. There were pretty significant changes made to the second act, but pretty much everything up to the intermission was word for word what I read, line for line. And, you know, it played out exactly, you know, even having read it already, I loved seeing it all play out on the screen. I loved seeing it realized. You know, I would say everything exceeded my expectations of what I sort of was imagining when I read it. I loved the performances. I mean, there were some that I would say the performances really brought the character to life in a way that I had perhaps been skeptical of when I was just reading it. And I would also say when I read it, probably my single biggest beef with it was that I felt like he didn't really know how to end it. The ending felt a little abrupt and didn't really seem like he knew where he was going with it yet. And I think that he tried to fix that since what I read. I don't know that he succeeded necessarily, because I still feel like watching the ending of this movie play out, it feels a little sloppy. It feels like it doesn't quite know exactly what it wants to do at the end. But it's closer to feeling like a complete ending than the version of the movie that I read. So I think he, and there are other things that play out differently in the second act of it too, that by the time we got into the second half of the movie, I really was watching it for the first time like everybody else, and I didn't know where it was going to go.
You know, Matt, it's interesting you say that it doesn't feel like it feels like it doesn't know what it wants to be by the end of it all, and that it's sloppy. I think that you could say that about the entire movie, at least from my perspective. It's a mixed bag. It's like just a mashup of a whole lot of stuff going on. And usually Tarantino is pretty adept at reining those kinds of things in and telling a pretty compelling story, even if it on the surface seems like there's a little too much on the table and it could get out of control fast. And I think that is probably what happens. Although, yeah, and I think I walked out of this movie while excited about a lot of what I had seen, because, you know, in all of this Star Wars madness and all these other movies that are coming out, I kind of forgot that there's a new Tarantino movie in theaters, and I kind of recharged my batteries and got excited again for that fact that I was on my way to see it, a new movie from one of our favorite filmmakers. You know, despite what I personally might think of his antics leading up to the release of this movie in interviews and other media, but I've got to say, now having watched this, and you and I both saw the 70mm projected roadshow version of this movie, which clocks in at about 3 hours, and I've got to say that I would probably designate this as lesser Tarantino. And you know, when it comes down to it, that's probably an easy descriptor for a lot of people because, I mean, having seen this one time, it's hard to say right off the bat that it measures up to the likes of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction and Kill Bill Volume 1 and all of these classics we have come to know Tarantino for. And we're coming off of what is a quasi-Western in Django Unchained, and what I think was sort of the culmination of all of these different things that Tarantino has amassed in his arsenal in terms of becoming less of the original maverick filmmaker that he was when he arrived on the scene in the early 1990s, and has become someone who has built a voice that is very much his own, but is fairly derivative when you boil it down to all of the moving parts that he incorporates from things that have influenced him through the course of his life and career as a filmmaker. And I think that there are elements of that in The Hateful Eight, but what I really appreciate about this movie is that it actually feels like something original from Tarantino again, although it does do some of those things. So I'm glad to see that Tarantino has strayed away from the noise that we've seen over the past few movies that he's made and instead chose to focus on the story and new characters. I just personally didn't really find the story all that compelling, and I found myself asking throughout and by the end of it, what does it all really mean and trying to say? Where does it all want to go? And I don't know that I found a satisfying answer.
No, I think that's totally fair, and the whole thing, to me, I think he probably should have spent another year or so on it. but because I think there's the seeds of something really, really cool in this movie. And it's so cool that it's really hard for me to feel negative about the movie. I mean, I'm going to sound pretty critical of it here because I think it has some fundamental flaws. But I'm not going to lie. I just so enjoyed the experience of watching it. And I think in some ways, I think that this is a bit of a return to, or an attempt to return to some of that stuff that you mentioned that made him such a successful filmmaker early in his career. You know, I think part of what made him successful early on was because nobody else had ever seen anything like that before. And this is still very clearly Tarantino, which is a thing that we know now. You know, it's a commodity that we recognize when we see it. But I think that he's gotten away from some of the things that made Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction feel so energetic and so captivating to watch and feel like more than just a big bag of camera tricks. And I think he tried to go back to that here. You know, I mean, I say that for a lot more reasons than just the obvious plot parallels with Reservoir Dogs that a lot of people are pointing out. I think the fact that this movie is, you know, essentially the telling in a chopped up chronological order, the telling of a tragic tale done with a sort of evil grin, is a tone that I'm glad to see again. And it's fun to watch it. I mean, to me, it's fairly obvious pretty early on that everybody's going to die, that this is not going to go well. And, you know, even if you're holding out hope for one of the characters, it's still pretty obvious that this is going to be a very grim, you know, black comedy where none of these characters are good guys. None of them are redeeming. And, you know, you're not really supposed to attach your heartstrings to them very much. At the same time, he's very into manipulating the audience, as he has always been. And I think he's as good at doing that in this movie as he has been since Kill Bill Volume 1, certainly, but maybe even from before that. And I have anecdotal evidence for that, too, but I remember reading it feeling that way. But I think he is really trying to make members of the audience who aren't, I don't know a better way to say it, but it's like, we're going to figure out who the cool kids are here and who's not with it, and I'm going to make some of you uncomfortable. And I think he seems to get some joy out of that. There are some filmmakers that do that, and I don't enjoy it, but I've always enjoyed it when Tarantino does it. And I think he does that here. I think there's some moments in this movie where my audience that I saw this with got very turned off. I heard them talking about it in the intermission, that they were not expecting it, and this isn't really what they signed up for, and they didn't like it. And I kind of liked that. I liked that it made them uncomfortable a little bit. Because, you know, it's Tarantino movies, to me, are always things that you better watch yourself from getting, you know, too wrapped up in the screen. You better see the edges of the screen at all times, because if you don't, you're going to get messed with. Because that's part of the deal with him, I think. And Ben, I think at one point specifically, I want to ask you about the end of the first act, basically. Not the first chapter, but basically what I mean is, you know, as we go into intermission, Samuel L. Jackson has a scene where he's pulling out a monologue where, whether it's true or not, he's basically trying to get under the skin of Bruce Dern's character so that he will pick up a gun so that Samuel L. Jackson can shoot him. And he tells essentially the most agitating, disturbing story he can possibly think of. And it works for him, and it works on the audience, too, because I think a lot of audience members were ready to bail after that. And I want to know how you felt about that portion of the movie.
Well, I think it's interesting you use the words pulling out when you're describing that. But, no, I think you make a great point, because, yes, I think you're right that Tarantino has a unique gift when it comes to manipulating his audience. The only issue that I think exists here is that I think that his hardcore fans are kind of onto his tricks and sort of know how to read his poker face, because that element is really important in this movie, because it's a mystery of sorts. And I've heard that he was pretty heavily influenced by someone like Agatha Christie and other mystery novelists out there in terms of how to weave this type of story. But I really liked that sequence, Matt. I thought it was funny, and I thought it was, you know, I thought it was a rare moment in this movie where he let a character paint a colorful picture in terms of adding to his own depth and arc moving forward. And yes, you're right. There's a weird parallel going on where Tarantino and Samuel Jackson's character are manipulating and, yes, trying to get under the skin of people and make them feel a certain way by telling a story, whether or not you believe what's going on. And, you know, I thought it was great. And I think Samuel Jackson, once again, under Tarantino's direction, is excellent here as Marquez Warren. And I think Bruce Dern also is fantastic in this movie. And I'm so glad that, you know, following his triumphant performance in Nebraska, Tarantino was one of the first people to jump on the bandwagon and cast him in one of these prestige movies. But, yeah, just going back to my point of Tarantino sort of not necessarily running out of tricks, because I think there are plenty of those in this. I just think that he's getting a little predictable in terms
Well, let me say this, though. I mean, so that scene, I have to say, I did not see it coming.
No, you're
when
right.
When I first read it. And
again,
in fact, when
choice
I,
of words, Matt. But
the first time I read that monologue when I was reading the screenplay, I thought that was the moment where I thought, okay, this isn't actually real. Like, there's no way this is in the movie. I thought that I had been duped into
like it was a joke, yeah, that you had
yeah.
indeed read the seventh grade fake Tarantino. Yeah.
If you can imagine reading that and not knowing for sure that it was a Quentin Tarantino script, I think a lot of people would look up and go, "Hold up."
Yeah, and the reason that moment worked for me is because, I mean, you have to sit there and think. I think what Tarantino might have been thinking was, what is the worst possible image that a black man in a post-Civil War United States could give to a retired Confederate general in that moment in time in our country's history, fake history as it is in this movie, but I just thought that was an incredible moment of tension that he created, probably something he had been thinking on for a long time. But no, you're totally right. That's kind of a make or break it moment for the audience, and it's very interesting that he does it at, you mentioned that it will make or break it for people, and we'll find out who the real fans are, because that moment comes seconds before the intermission where he gives people an opportunity to walk out of this thing.
Yeah, I don't. Now I didn't look around at the crowd after the intermission to see if everybody came back. But I mean, it seemed. I definitely heard a lot of discussion, and I think that's cool. I know most people won't see the movie that way, but it was a very fun, unique experience at a movie to have that happen, and people are getting up and going to refill their drinks or going to the bathroom, and you're hearing conversations halfway through the movie. That's something that doesn't usually happen until it's all the way over. And I'm not totally sure, how I feel about it, because you're essentially giving people an opportunity to start to influence each other's opinions before the movie's over. But it's certainly different and interesting as a way to watch a movie. And, I think overall it added to my enjoyment of the movie, because I liked that opportunity to kind of step back and look at how he was playing this audience. And yeah, I know that you and I are fanboys of Tarantino, and we've seen everything he's done multiple times, and maybe we're a little jaded for some of his tricks, but they obviously still work. I'll say this, that crowd looked like a very mixed crowd, age-wise, background-wise, and they were all having very different reactions to what they had seen in the first half of the movie. And not only that, Ben, but then when you come back in the second half, I think one of the things he does in this movie really well is he lets you see where the gears are turning. He assumes that you're smart enough. And he doesn't, frankly, ask that much of you, but he knows that the audience wants to see the clockwork behind the face, and so he's not shy about showing you the pieces starting to interlock and starting to weave together. And well, in fact, I think that's part of the fun is you know more than the other characters do, and really the entire second half of the movie is based on the fact that you have. They start you off with a piece of information that, the other characters don't have. And it's like, okay, he literally has his voiceover coming in and going, let's see what happens.
Right. Quentin Tarantino's own voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, it could be that, Matt, but I think it could also reflect the fact that maybe Tarantino's not as clever as he thinks and knows he is, and this is a guy who I think has certainly bought into his own hype over the years, and some of it has been justified, but some of it I think has been slightly empty, especially recently. I love Inglourious Basterds. I love, parts of Django Unchained, but I think that, each of those films has, has weaknesses. And I think that, again, it goes back to that sort of new Tarantino director that much different from the guy who gave us those first several movies, the new voice, and somebody, like you said, whose work we'd never seen before. And yeah, again, I found it very refreshing that there are sparks of that guy in The Hateful Eight. I kept kind of looking for the other guy to rear his head, and I think that he does it way less than we've seen in previous movies. And again, that's not to say that that those movies were not just like enormously entertaining, because they definitely are. And this one definitely is, for the most part. And you know, the entertainment value isn't necessarily where I think the movie is lacking. Again, I go to story and I go to character, and I think of a character like Kurt Russell's bounty hunter, John Ruth, the hangman, and some other characters, Daisy Domergue or whatever. Like, they, to me, there's not much interesting about them beyond what we're told about them on the movie's poster, right? Like, what their character is called. Like,
yeah, they're broadly drawn, for sure.
Yeah,
Everybody is.
Kurt Russell's a bounty hunter. She's a villain. You know, if you go back again to Pulp Fiction, the least interesting thing about Vincent and Jules is that they're hitmen, right? I mean, there's so much more depth to those guys. And what was so interesting about what Tarantino was doing is that he's giving you the sort of the guys behind those guys, right? And we're getting to know those people. And I know that he's not necessarily setting out to make that same movie with those same characters, but I just think that we're finally seeing Tarantino sort of running out of gas in a way, creatively. And I think that there were, again, elements of that old guy here where he had sort of found something he didn't have over the past few movies and sort of, again, recharged those batteries. But I just didn't really find much compelling about the characters beyond what they told us initially in terms of like what their primary objectives were. I didn't really see much below the surface with many of the characters, other than perhaps Marquez Warren and the character Chris Mannix, here played by Walton Goggins, Birmingham native of Walton Goggins, who I think has more depth than most of the characters we see.
I do think that's interesting that you bring him up, because to me, he's the kind of the perfect example of what this movie is about, the essence of this movie, which to me, it really isn't about going in depth with the characters, although I do agree that Warren is a really fascinating character and that we get a lot more into his motivations and backstory. Although it's not entirely clear whether most or all of what he even says about who he is true.
Right.
But that said, I think these characters are largely, I think they're very broadly drawn, in part because this movie is a very broad setup for a sort of ridiculous, over-the-top, bloody Western plot. And I think the Walton Goggins character is kind of the perfect example of it, because he only speaks in exposition. He has no internal life at all. There's nothing that he's thinking that he does not say out loud. And part of that is what makes him fun. I think that's what makes him an amusing character to watch, is he is so surface. I mean, he's such an idiot, but he's also, you know, kind of our window into the plot, because if he thinks something, he's going to say it out loud. And John Ruth is a little bit similar too. He's a tough guy and he's a badass, but he's very naive. And he trusts everybody in the movie too much, every single character. And, you know, I think that's kind of, I guess, part of the appeal of this movie to me, and what made it feel different for Tarantino, is these are not, you know, he talks often about his movies that are set in a semi-real world, which, you know, I think he would say Pulp Fiction is that, maybe Jackie Brown is that, and he has his, I think the term he uses is movies, which are like movies that people inside movies would watch. And to me, this is very much meant to be one of those. It is a very, broadly drawn movie, and that's certainly a valid criticism of it too. But I think that's part of the charm of it to me, is these characters are very simple parts, and it's the way that they end up bouncing off of each other and interacting that's interesting. It's the fact that, you know, even when we become aware largely of what's going on here, we still don't really know what's going to happen next, or how exactly it's going to play out. And, you know, some of these characters do stuff for kind of nonsensical reasons, because they're all paranoid and they're all locked in a room together and they don't know who to trust. So, you know, I think the simplicity of it, if you wanted to call it lazy, I couldn't necessarily argue against it, but I think it's also part of what I like about the movie is that it's so simple and it's kind of this stripped down version of Tarantino where it's just about, let me see what I can do with these very basic parts and sort of whether I can still involve the audience, entertain them, shock them with what happens. I think for most of, you know, for a movie where the vast majority of it is about characters talking to each other and trying to figure out what's going on, it still feels like there's a pretty consistent tension throughout the movie. And that's impressive to me. I mean, this is not a movie that is filled with action. And yet, I never really felt a lull. I never really felt the tension slow down, you know?
Yeah, well, no, it doesn't. And it's like, it is definitely a compelling movie from A to Z. But again, my fundamental issue with the whole thing is regardless of the tension that it does create, I'm just not sure I'm very interested in the existing tension between the characters that you're talking about and that he introduces here. I just don't really see much of an end game by the time we wind the story down. And you know, the characters that we're left with are probably the most likable of the movie and the ones we want to spend the most time with, but by the time we end up with them, the dialogue that's coming out of their mouths, like you said, reminds me of one of those sort of silly movies that characters within movies would be watching, right? It's just, it's all very,
yeah,
very
hokey. The end is definitely still not right. I can say that. I will say the original ending definitely felt unfinished. And, you know, I think you can feel the effort going into ending this movie. And that's not a good thing. I think he's having to really labor to figure out, all right, what do I do? How do I leave this? You know, I mean, do I sit here and wait for the gang to show up and kill them? Do I have them all be dead instantly at the same time? It's like he never really could figure out what would feel right as an ending to this movie. And the ending we get, you use the word hokey. I think that's a good word for it. It feels kind of silly. And I just think he couldn't figure out the right way to end it, which, you know, if you can't figure it out, and maybe he thinks he did, but if you can't figure out a great ending, I think your movie's not done yet. And I think you probably shouldn't make it yet.
Yeah, and if you didn't want to make this movie in the first place, then don't make it, you know? And if the audience who clamored for you to do that just because you got upset after the script got leaked and you didn't want to do anything with it other than maybe turn it into a novel after the live read, then just do that and move on to the next thing. But look, Tarantino is probably the one guy who you can't really, you know, Tarantino makes every movie the way he wants to make it, right? Like he's going to make the movie his way, and he's probably chiefly the guy you can say that most definitively about. So I'm not going to sit here and pretend, you know, to tell him how to make his movie necessarily, but I don't know. I have found characters in the past in his work far more compelling than I do it here. And if that's deliberate, that's fine. I just don't know that the story he's telling is worth really telling if there isn't anyone or anything that we can either emotionally invest in or just latch onto for the sake of compulsion. And you know, that's just how I felt walking out of it. And that being said, I go back to the things I really loved about this movie. And again, that the performances, obviously, I think, like you said, the setup is really terrific. The first half, especially, I think specifically Walton Goggins, Samuel Jackson, Kurt Russell. I mean, pretty much everybody in the movie is really good. Demian Bashir
is so great. It's such a spaghetti Western Mexican character. Like,
yeah,
that there are no people that actually speak that way.
Or talk with their eyes closed the way he
right?
does.
That is like an American person overdubbing a Mexican character.
He's like a Looney Tune,
yeah.
Really. But no, Ennio Morricone's score, which I know is a big source of anticipation for this, especially, I know you're an ardent fan of his, as am I. I think the score is great in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
The theme itself is really terrific, especially during the opening of this movie. I think the opening credits is one of the best aspects of this movie, especially the first shot we see really super tight on this cross.
Oh, awesome.
It slowly backs out as these credits are revealed and we hear the score for the first time.
It's a horror score, really.
Yep, for sure. That's what I thought when the opening credits were happening. I thought, is this Tarantino's horror movie, even more than Death Proof? Are we in for that? And in ways, perhaps. But no, it didn't go full on horror. And it makes you wonder, was that score specifically written for The Hateful Eight, or was it recycled from something else?
I don't know. I do think at times, I will say this movie sometimes reminded me of an Evil Dead movie in some ways. So I don't think there's no relationship with horror in this movie. I think
right.
it has some qualities of a self-aware, you know, like Sam Raimi-esque splatter gore horror movie, I think.
I definitely see that for sure. And what I do find interesting, Matt, is what you said, something that you found charming about the movie. Is it charming here where it sort of bugs you a little bit more in the grindhouse experience that you had? Because I know that you've been a critic of that and saying, you know, I think the way you put it back then, and correct me if I'm wrong, was there's nothing cool about making a bad movie on purpose. You know, it doesn't really seem productive. Did it have the reverse effect on you this time? Not to say that Hateful Eight is a bad movie made on purpose, but like you mentioned, just in terms of the quote-unquote hokey element that we talked about, do you think that maybe works better here than it did in a previous effort?
I definitely feel that way. Although, as I said, I don't think the ending works. But I honestly, I don't think that Tarantino is very good at writing endings of movies. I would say he doesn't really have any good endings other than Reservoir Dogs, probably. But anyway, that's a totally different point. But I think that the main difference here is I think he tried to be self-aware, cool, hip Tarantino when he made Death Proof and still make the bad-on-purpose grindhouse movie. And it didn't – that combination still to this day doesn't work for me. I don't think you can have the hammy, cheesy elements that happen in that movie and have a bunch of, you know – sort of cheerleaders talking about nothing with each other for half the movie before that. And he doesn't try to do that here. I mean, there is no dialogue in this movie where someone spends 15 minutes weaving an elaborate metaphor. There's none of that in this movie. Everything, all of the dialogue is completely serving the plot.
Yeah.
And you know, I think sometimes it's almost silly. Like, you know, a thing that kind of keeps coming back to me in this movie is the fact that the Walton Goggins character, he'll sort of make a realization that we already know about, and he'll sort of like, he can't stop repeating it out loud. Like, let me make sure I understand this. You got a letter from Abraham Lincoln. Like,
that was great. He's,
you know,
great,
like,
in that scene.
I mean, that's like, he's the character in the movie that's like, I'm a lot slower than everybody else watching this, but I got to make sure. But it's almost like it was made. It's something that would be in a movie like that, because it's you know, the filmmaker going, all right, well, my audience might be stupid, so I need to let them catch up here. But I think Tarantino knows that nobody is. It's just part of the movie that makes it feel like a movie. And I liked that about it. I thought that was funny. I thought he was a very entertaining character to watch. And I think ultimately the fact that the dialogue still always feels true to the genre and the identity of the movie to me. You know, I think there are Tarantino-isms in the dialogue, but they always feel like they should be in a movie like this. They feel like they belong in this movie, and he wasn't trying to make six different kinds of movies all woven together. I feel like this movie has a pretty cohesive identity. Even if it doesn't always work, I think that this movie mostly knows what it is and what it's trying to be. And, you know, I like that about it. It's a movie that you can settle into and feel the world of this movie. And it mostly follows that world that it sets up, I think. And, you know, I don't think I can say that about Death Proof. I don't think I can say that about Kill Bill Volume 2. I don't think I can say that about Django Unchained either. I think that those movies at times feel like they were very confused about their identity and the tone that they were trying to go for. And I never felt comfortable with them. I never felt like I knew what those movies were trying to do. And I do think this one is much more cohesive from that standpoint. And I like that about it.
I will agree with you on that point, in that it's way less anachronistic than a lot of these other recent movies, which at times feel like sort of like sizzle reels of these little devices that Tarantino has fallen in love with. And you can sort of tell he can't wait to use this graphic or this sound effect or this little 5-second piece of music that he thinks will help sort of like weave that story or create this really just spotty mishmash of an identity and experience.
Can I say too, another really good point, you bring up the music. This movie does have anachronistic music in it, and yet it all fits the movie. The White Stripes song, Apple Blossom, that they play, to me, it totally was the perfect choice. And I was a little taken aback by it for a minute, and as it played out, I thought, man, this is great. This is that. What a great choice for that moment in the movie. And, you know, I don't think I feel that way about everything in Django, especially when there's a, you know, the movie breaks into a shootout where Jamie Foxx is on the ones and twos in the middle of a James Brown song.
Yeah, that was kind of a, I don't know, that was kind of a low point for me, too, in terms of, like, Tarantino sort of, again, buying his own hype, sort of reflecting the idea that he can do whatever he wants no matter what, and he certainly can. He just has shown a little more discipline in the past, and he definitely does that more so this time. But, you know, something that, again, sort of bugged me about it is, as you mentioned, Death Proof and Kill Bill Volume 2, and those are, you know, again, at the bottom of Tarantino filmography for us personally, I know, and definitely for me. But at the start of Act 2, we meet some characters that have only been mentioned by the characters that we've spent time with in Act 1. And for me, it started to drift into the diner scene in Death Proof or the wedding party or wedding rehearsal scene in Kill Bill Volume 2 that felt a little wonky for me. And I like where they went with it, for sure. And it was good to sort of have that, you know, that trademark nonlinear moment that we're used to getting from Quentin Tarantino. But I felt like some time was wasted getting that act started, even though, you know, what the characters we had spent time with in Act 1 did by the end of that sequence of Act 2. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good part. I think it's a good time in the movie to do what he's trying to do there, which is, you know, he at a certain point, you know, he's got to show you what actually happened. And I think it's better to show you than to have somebody go out there and monologue what happened, because that wouldn't make any sense. But I think in execution, he probably took a little too long to do it. And, you know, we're probably spending a little too much time with some characters that are going to be cannon fodder pretty quickly. And I think we probably could have made that whole thing happen faster. Another thing, and I hate to keep bringing it up on paper because it's weird. It's not something we normally do on a podcast like this, but that whole part worked a lot better on the page than it did watching it in the movie. It felt weirdly like a much more vibrant part of the movie. And, you know, I think some of it maybe was that some of the characters and scenes, you know, if you're going to do what he tried to do, I think you either need to do it quick or you need to really pull off developing Minnie and Sweet Dave and some of those other characters. And, you know, I don't think it really came off well. I think the maybe some of it was casting, but you know, Minnie's character basically gets a cute line about how fat her butt is, and that's basically all we get from her. And you know, other than making them reasonably likable, their characters are really not very well drawn in what we see, and yet we spend what feels like kind of a lot of time with them. I actually like Zoe Bell's performance a lot. I thought she did a really good job, and that was a fun piece of that scene, I think.
Yeah, well, I found myself caring more about Minnie and Sweet Dave when Kurt Russell and Samuel L. Jackson would talk about them as opposed to when I finally met them.
Yeah, you know? That's right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Maybe that's the strength of his writing, though. But, yeah, Matt, you know, I also want to focus on the theatrical experience that you and I had with this movie, which has obviously been part of the narrative of this film's existence and release, in that it was shot in 70mm, it's been screened in 70mm, and at the theater in Birmingham where we saw it, it has a program, an overture, an intermission, all part of what is, you know, part of this roadshow experience. Did that whole thing really do it for you, or was it all just sort of pomp and circumstance?
It was a minor addition, but I really liked it. I liked that entire aspect of it. I don't think it made me any more or less likely to see the movie, but I sure liked it. And, you know, look, I don't know, that program can't have cost them, you know, 10 cents to make, but I liked it. I like that I have it now. I think it's cool and it's good looking, and it's nothing huge, but I think it's neat. And I'd love to have had one for The Force Awakens or some of the other big releases that I saw this year. You know, I'd love to have one of those for a movie that I felt like was an event. And, you know, I liked the overture. I know you for practical reasons, you really can't do that with every movie, but it made sense with this movie. I liked it. And I will say this, definitely the thing that had the biggest effect on the experience was the intermission. And like I said, I can't really decide if it's overall a positive or negative thing, but, you know, it was fun to me to kind of watch it play out and to experience kind of a little stopping point in the middle of the movie where everybody kind of takes stock and you hear people talking about it. And, you know, I could foresee some of our fellow film nerds not liking that about it because they don't want to be influenced by other people before the movie is done. But I kind of liked that about it. And maybe it's just this movie, you know, because it's a movie where you're so aware that you are watching a movie and that there is an audience in there with you, that became a fun part of the experience for me. I enjoyed it, though. I liked those elements. I mean, I mostly just like the overture because it's more Morricone. But I think the little things that were done as a part of this roadshow experience made me enjoy the entire thing more. And it certainly led to, you know, the final minutes before it, the anticipation was higher for me than it would have been if I was just sitting there watching the Coca-Cola commercial waiting for the movie to come on.
Yeah, no trailers as part of this experience, which is really interesting. It just, like you told me before I went and saw it, it just jumps into the overture. And I like the overture, the intermission, the program. I love all that stuff. Now, the aspect of it that just didn't really do anything for me at all was the 70mm thing. And you know,
yeah,
that may make me, you know, a villain in the eyes of film purists out there, but I happen to really like digital projection. I just do. I think that we see exactly what guys like Robert Richardson and other filmmakers were specifically going for when they when they composed and colored those shots. And I want to see as crisp a picture as possible. And I understand Tarantino, where he's coming from and everything, but at this point, he just kind of sounds like a stubborn little kid when it comes to the film experience as opposed to digital projection. And it reminded me, watching it, the look of it and everything, it reminded me of growing up and going to the Fox 12 or Bama 6 in Tuscaloosa or whatever theater I happened to go to when there were 35-millimeter projections. And it sort of, in retrospect, makes me feel like we were all just sort of, you know, biding our time until we finally got digital projection technology to get the best possible picture we could get. So I don't really know that I walked out of this thinking, wow, I'm so glad that they projected this in 70mm. It's the way to go, and curse the industry for leaving it behind. I'm still fine with digital projection, and I'd like to see The Hateful Eight in a digital projection.
I'd be lying if I told you I could tell a difference, to be honest. I mean, I liked seeing it on the IMAX screen for sure. I thought it was a monster picture. You know, there's so much to look at, especially those outdoor shots, which is amazing. And I saw it with my dad, and actually he noticed there's, I think it's when the second act starts, they duplicate the carriage shot where the horses are sort of running across the screen past the crucifix. And there's a caption on the bottom left of the screen, and he didn't see it there until it was already fading, and he's like, oh man, I didn't even notice they put any words up on the screen until they were starting to fade away, because it's like, you know, your eyes didn't even make it all the way over.
Yeah,
it was just a massive picture, which, yeah, you know, I liked that about it, but I think ultimately quality wise it did not make a difference to me. I heard a lot of people in the theater around me going like, hey, you know, this is 70mm, right? Like, it's just more of a thing of like, let's tell people that's what it is. Nobody really cares.
Well, you know, I think that just from a strictly what you see up there, and just from a projection standpoint, I think if you did a taste test or a sight test, you'd notice the differences in terms of like, it's much grainier, it's softer, and it just kind of reminds me of like, when you hear all these filmmakers talk about Blu-ray, right, and the transfers, how I can finally show people what I was really going for here, and that makes more sense to me than ever after watching. Yet, you know, even if it's a 70mm projection, you know, maybe the same was true for The Master when that was shown in 70mm. Yes, it reminds me of the time I saw movies when I was growing up, or when I've seen them on different screens that used actual film projections, but I personally believe in evolution and feel like we have evolved into the good era of you know, theatrical film viewing that involves digital projection that gives us the sharpest possible quality of picture that we can get. And I think that his movie, Tarantino's movie, would also benefit from those transfers.
You only believe in science.
That's right, exactly. So, no, I look, fine, whatever, you know, I applaud and admire the crusade that guys like Tarantino and Christopher Nolan and Wes Anderson and Paul Thomas Anderson are on out there in terms of preserving film. But, you know, I also applaud guys like Fincher and Linklater and Scorsese for at least embracing the inevitable and something that makes their picture look as good as it possibly can in terms of how the audience sees what they are going for when it comes to, again, framing and coloring and coming up with the image that lives inside their head. Again, it all feels like a bit of stubbornness on Tarantino's part, and it's a battle that he's going to end up losing, unfortunately. But, you know, again, I admire his grit.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's a guy who is committed to the identity he's created for himself right now. He claims he's got two movies left, and I expect them to feel very much like Tarantino movies, because all of his movies have. And, you know, I will say this is not his best movie that he's ever made, for sure, but I did enjoy it a lot, and I enjoyed it a lot more than his last movie. And I'm encouraged enough that I am excited about whatever his next two movies might end up being.
Well, let me ask you quickly before we stop here, unfairly rank this after only seeing it one time. Where does it fall on the Tarantino filmography for you, if you're ranking it?
So it is behind, you know, it's behind Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, obviously. I'd say it's behind Kill Bill 1. It's behind Jackie Brown for me, because I just feel like Jackie Brown all the way through feels, you know, much more complete than this movie does, as we've been discussing. But this, to me, this is a better movie than Volume 2. This is a better movie than, I guess I didn't mention Inglourious Basterds. I would put Inglourious Basterds ahead of this. But this is a better movie than Death Proof or Django or Kill Bill Volume 2, I would say.
I think that's fair. I think that, yeah, for me, I'm with you, that Death Proof and Kill Bill are way down there. Django is slightly above those, and I think this may be slightly above Django.
Yeah, I just think this will stand out to me as a, even though it's 3 hours when you put it all together, it feels like a little project for him. You know,
good, it really does.
It feels like he sort of did this little side thing, and I like that about it, that it feels small, and it's a bunch of actors that I like, and I like watching them work in this movie. I like Michael Madsen in this movie too, who we haven't even talked about, but you know, it's just fun to watch him get up there and be a you know, nasty badass in this movie for a little while and sort of get back to his sort of archetype in Tarantino movies. I like Tim Roth's character, even though it's, you know, very silly. There's so many characters in this movie, even though they're broad and I don't end up caring whether they live or die. I just really have fun watching them do what they do while they're up there.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com and aspectradioshow.com.